Friday, January 22nd. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Rohith Joseph. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:05 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with Harsha Walia. Harsha talks about her participation in UBC's Sexual Assault Awareness Month and issues around sexualized violence.
We also have an analysis of the U.S. Democrat debate produced by News 101 correspondents Albert Von Sant and John Woodside.
Following that, we have Curious by Nature, a new segment from our science reporter, Michael Ruffalo. Drones were one of the hottest items for purchase this holiday season, and as their numbers in the sky increase, the danger to animals climb with it.
To conclude the show, we have a piece from CITR's Indigenous Collective, Unceded Airwaves. Host Celia Joseph interviewed Ganarji O'Sullivan. Ganarji is a radio powerhouse in Vancouver who has several radio shows on the go and is the creator of the Red Jam Slam Society. They discuss the value and roles of radio in Indigenous communities. Ganarji shares her relationship with radio and the various ways it has helped her heal and become a stronger person.
But first, for some headlines for today. In campus news, the AMS approves external sexual assault policy. The AMS is calling on UBC to develop a policy specifically designed to deal with sexual assault. Currently, the university only has a general policy that applies to all non-academic misconduct. However, Jana Omasi, AMS VP Academic and University Affairs, says, quote, "The way in which sexual assault needs to be dealt with is in a very different way than other assaults. This means policy is needed to address the specific challenges associated with sexual assault. This includes avoiding proceedings where survivors are placed in the same room as their perpetrators." The AMS external policy recommends that the new UBC policy take a victim-centered approach. Other recommendations include creating a sexual assault response team and providing reformative education for perpetrators. Both Omasi and Ashley Bentley, the director of the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center, will be present at meetings for the creation of the new policy.
In local news, Tsleil-Waututh Nation government distances itself from activist takeover of Kinder Morgan Barge. Activists who seized a Kinder Morgan Barge were not instructed by the Tsleil-Waututh elected government, according to a statement released by the nation earlier this week. The seven activists who boarded a drilling barge near Westbridge Terminal are currently under RCMP custody. They claim to have operated with permission of the hereditary chiefs. However, under the Indian Act, only the elected chief and council can govern the nation. Chief Maureen Thomas is the elected leader of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation. In her statement to the press, Chief Maureen Thomas said, quote, "While we respect all those opposed to the expansion and their perspectives on the best way to voice that opposition, the Tsleil-Waututh Nation government will continue to oppose the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project by all legal means necessary." North Vancouver senior sentenced for setting mountain biking traps. A 64-year-old North Vancouver woman was sentenced to 3 years probation and 150 hours of community service for setting booby traps on bike trails. Tanika Kral pled guilty to the charge of mischief, rendering property dangerous, useless, or inoperative in September. For 2 years, Kral sabotaged mountain trails by moving branches and obstacles onto bike paths on Mount Fromm earlier in the morning. Kral was caught when concerned mountain bikers set up hidden infrared cameras along the trails. According to her lawyer, Martin Peters, Kral liked hiking the soft terrain of the trails as therapy for her arthritis, but felt that bikers were ruining the trails. He said she set up the traps to slow down bikers and preserve the trail for hikers. Kral said of her actions in court, quote, "I never wanted to hurt anybody. I'm just really sorry." Kral's actions have been heavily criticized on social media.
In national news, CP Rail to cut 1,000 jobs. Canadian Pacific Railway announced during an earnings call that it plans to cut 1,000 jobs this year. When asked by an investor, CP CEO Hunter Harrison said, quote, "There's probably 1,000 additional heads to come out potentially in 2016. This comes in response to reduced demand as the Canadian economy continues its slump. However, despite the slump, CP earned a record of $1.35 billion in profit in 2015. The jobs are expected to be cut through attrition, where employees leave a company voluntarily through resignation or retirement throughout the year. This announcement comes days after CP was hit with an order from Transport Canada to reorganize its freight lines and change its fatigue management practices, citing excessive fatigue among rail workers that pose, quote, an immediate threat to safe railway operations. Post Media merges newsrooms, cuts 90 jobs. Bad news for Canadian journalists. Post Media cut 90 jobs across Canada this week. These cuts came as newsrooms merged in four cities, from Vancouver to Ottawa. Edmonton newspapers were hit hardest, with 35 jobs cut, including the managing editor and editor-in-chief. Post Media's finances have sagged since they bought the Sun media chain from Quebecor for $316 million in 2014. Only the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail remain outside of the Post Media banner. Late last year, Post Media had a net loss of $4.2 million. However, President and CEO Paul Godfrey earned $1.76 million in 2015 compared to $1.42 million in 2014. The merger has been heavily criticized by journalists and union workers. Unifor President Jerry Diaz said, quote, centralized news gathering and opinions, including in local news, do not add to the national debate that helps build a functioning democracy.
In international news, Daniel Holtzclaw sentenced to 263 years in prison. Yesterday, Oklahoma County Judge Timothy Henderson upheld the December verdict sentencing Daniel Holtzclaw to 263 years in prison. A request for a new trial by Holtzclaw's lawyers was also denied. Holtzclaw, a former Oklahoma City police officer, was found guilty in December of 18 counts of rape, sexual battery, and other crimes. 13 black women testified that he used his position in order to assault them and intimidate them into silence. Three survivors gave impact statements during Thursday's trial. One survivor, known as A, said, quote, I was 17 when this happened with Mr. Holtzclaw, and ever since this happened, my life has been upside down. I can't take the stress anymore. I feel like I'm dying on the inside. Prosecutors argued that Holtzclaw preyed on vulnerable women with criminal histories who lived on the fringes of their low-income neighborhood because they would be less likely to report. The case gained wide publicity due to the all-white jury and the fact that he targeted black women. National Organization for Women President Terry O'Neill said of the sentencing, quote, we heard about long-term consequences, so know that Daniel Holtzclaw is going to spend the rest of his life in prison. It's important for us to not to forget that the issue continues.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments. Just a big mistake. It's nothing more.
Need to talk? AMS Speakeasy offers free, one-on-one, confidential, drop-in peer support sessions with trained volunteers. Our goal is to lend a listening ear and empower you to continue to strive towards wellness. Our services are available Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. during exam season. Support sessions can be requested at our desk on the main floor of the Nest or by ringing the doorbell outside our private space in room 3121. Learn more by visiting the AMS Speakeasy website. No issue is too big or too small. We're here to listen.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, News 101 co-director Emily Blake and her interview with Harsha Walia.
Harsha Walia is a social justice activist known for co-founding the Vancouver chapter of No One Is Illegal. She has been active in anti-racist, migrant justice, Indigenous solidarity, feminist, anti-imperialist, and Palestine solidarity movements for over a decade. Her written work has appeared in numerous books, journals, and magazines, and she is also the author of Undoing Border Imperialism. As well, Naomi Klein has referred to her as, quote, one of Canada's most brilliant and effective political organizers. I interviewed Harsha about her participation in the panel discussion, Coming Together at the Intersections, Sexualized Violence in Our Communities, for UBC's Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We discussed structures of violence, the universality of sexualized violence, and bridging gaps between communities.
I was wondering why it was important for you to participate in this talk.
I think it's important primarily because it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month at UBC. And, you know, it's critical for a range of reasons. One is, of course, at UBC in particular, there has been, just not even recently, but over the past year, 2 years, there's been such a crisis around sexual assault and sexual violence. And this gendered violence, of course, takes many forms. You know, it's also racialized, for example, the chants from last year. But, you know, we've also seen that the administration in general has done absolutely nothing to address sexual violence on campus. And so I think what's incredible about the fact that Sexual Assault Awareness Month is happening at UBC and part of this panel is, you know, students really taking charge and taking ownership over their campus and really saying that sexual violence and the climate of fear for those who are speaking out about sexual violence needs to end. And so I think it's a really important initiative that students have been taking around addressing sexual violence on their campus and really putting forward and educating folks around what rape culture is and what's needed around consent culture and really developing a consent culture on campus.
So the theme of the talk is sexual violence in our communities. And I know you've worked a lot with Indigenous and migrant communities. What specifically do you want to talk about and raise awareness to during the talk?
I think one of the things that's important to understand with respect to sexual violence and the ways it impacts women differently is really understanding the intersections of sexual violence. So I think one of the key things when we're talking about, for example, Indigenous women and migrant women, as you're saying, is that it's not just that Indigenous women and migrant women, for example, experience higher rates of sexual violence, which is true, right? We know, for example, that Indigenous women are 5 times more likely to experience violence in their lifetime than non-Indigenous women. But it's also that that violence is not just quantitatively different, it's also qualitatively different, which is to say that the different structures and the culture that informs that violence is different. And so, you know, one key example, for example, in the feminist movement that we have to contend with is, you know, what is the role of the police and criminal justice system in addressing sexual violence? So traditionally, one of the ways in which sexual violence has been addressed has been through the criminal justice system, through police, through the court. But we know, for example, for immigrant women and Indigenous women, those systems simply do not work because those systems are also deeply racist. For example, for migrant women who may report sexual violence against an intimate partner, it means that their partner may be subject to deportation depending on their legal status. And so it makes it much less plausible that women are going to rely on those systems as solutions. We know, for example, that, you know, Human Rights Watch, an international human rights organization, did a report over several years about how the RCMP in northern BC were actually a root cause of violence against women. So if we know that the justice system is also complicit in committing violence against Indigenous women, then Indigenous women are not going to rely on the colonial system for justice and redress. And so I think understanding those intersections are really important because it means the ways in which we understand violence and therefore the ways in which we will look to solutions and ways of resolving violence look entirely different based on who is facing that violence. And so it's not just understanding different women different marginalized women as experiencing more violence, it's also understanding that those causes are very different. The roots of those violence are different. And therefore, the ways in which we talk about and resolve violence and redress violence and restitute violence will look entirely different. And so it requires a multiplicity of solutions for different women.
And touching on migrant communities, there's been a lot of talk in the news since the attacks in New Year's Eve in Cologne, Germany, mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. concerns about migrants being perpetrators mm-hmm. of sexualized violence. So I was wondering yeah. if you could touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's nothing new, right? You know, migrant men in particular and migrant communities have often and always been cast as dangerous and particularly as sexual threats. And so going back to, you know, not just what's happening in Cologne right now, but going back to, you know, the history of these lands, the Yellow Peril was basically an entire construction of Asian men as being dangerous and threatening to white women. We know the history of racism, particularly anti-black racism, has been rooted, deeply rooted in the construction of black men being positioned as inherently dangerous and threatening to white women. And so the idea of migrant communities and migrant men as being particularly barbaric, innately patriarchal, in the post-9/11 climate, for example, Islam is being construed as inherently barbaric and patriarchal, and that this is part of the narrative in Cologne and in Germany, right, is the anti-Islamophobic or the Islamophobic and anti-Muslim narrative of it all. This is nothing new. And this is something that, you know, Gayatri Spivak very kind of bluntly called the ideology of feminist imperialism, the idea of couching imperialism and racism under a feminist cover, and what she called a very long history of white men and white women trying to save brown women from brown men and to save white women from brown men. And so I think it's really important to, in addressing sexual violence and in addressing the rape and the kind of horrific mass violence that took place in Cologne and everywhere else, to talk about sexual violence as something that is universal. It is not something that is endemic to migrant communities. It is not something that is endemic to any one culture or ethnicity or race. It is universal. And the danger of talking about the sexual violence in Cologne in the way that it is being talked about in mainstream media is twofold, right? One is the racism that it perpetuates, the anti-migrant racism that it fuels. And the second is that it absolves us of looking at the ways in which white supremacist patriarchy in particular has been the most devastating form of patriarchy across this world in terms of its intersections with imperialism. And this is something that we see in Canada as well, right? The very particular emphasis on migrant communities as being patriarchal, the emphasis on honor killings, for example, that's being positioned by the Canadian state over the past few years, where, you know, the Barbaric Cultural Practices Act that the past government talked about, but also that the Liberal government prior to this government has talked about, you know, when John Chrétien was around and Paul Martin was around. This history of talking about honor killings and particularly emphasizing patriarchy as endemic to migrant communities absolves Canada of looking at the fact that, you know, for example, most of the perpetrators against Indigenous women who are the most susceptible to violence have been white men. And it absolves the Canadian state and society at large of looking at the ways in which patriarchy and sexual violence is actually absolutely universal. It's not unique or specific to one culture or one community. And so I think it's imperative to talk about sexual violence as universal, to talk about sexual violence and patriarchy as a system and not something that's inherent to a culture or a community.
So there's a universality to sexualized violence, but I think oftentimes there's a disconnect between what's happening, say, on UBC campus versus mm-hmm. what's happening in the downtown east side and other communities. Mm-hmm. What can we do to bridge that gap?
I think the thing that's critical around talking about sexual violence and patriarchy is understanding and recognizing that it is a universal kind of system, right? And everyone that is subject to heteropatriarchy and lives that experience knows what it means to live under sexualized violence and to live under patriarchy, while also recognizing the specificity of experience, right? It is possible to talk about the universality of patriarchy while also talking about the specificity of it that, as we were talking about earlier, means that some people and some women in particular are much more susceptible to violence because they're living at the intersection of a number of systems. And that's also true at UBC, right? Not everyone who's experiencing violence at UBC is experiencing it in the same way. Some students are likely much more vulnerable to sexualized violence than others, which is not in any way to diminish the severity of sexual violence that everybody faces, but it's being attentive to specificity. And so I think it's entirely possible to talk about patriarchy as a universal system while recognizing the different experiences that come from different forms of privilege that make some people much more susceptible to violence. And so in order to talk about, as you're saying, you know, what are the links that people can draw between UBC and the downtown east side, for example, I think there's many. And I think also there's gestures of solidarity that are imperative, right? So if students at UBC are understanding how endemic sexual violence can be in an institution like UBC, which prides itself on being, you know, a first-class institution with access to resources and a place of relative, you know, economic privilege in terms of those who have access to higher education, then I think it also behooves students at UBC to understand that the kind of violence that women in the downtown east side are facing and the kind of victim blaming that women in the downtown east side are subject to, right? The idea that women in the downtown east side or sex workers are responsible for the violence on their bodies is something that students are much better placed to take up. That is a stereotype that students are in a good place to challenge, because a lot of those stereotypes actually are formed in classrooms. And so it becomes a good place to challenge their peers, to challenge other students, to challenge teachers when these kinds of narratives, anti-Indigenous, anti-downtown east side, anti-sex working, anti-poor narratives are brought up. And so I think one of the really key ways in which UBC students can forge alliances with women in the downtown east side is particularly to take up the issue of sexualized violence in the downtown east side at UBC and to express those solidarities in very concrete and tangible ways.
What do you see as some of the biggest misunderstandings or challenges to people understanding sexualized violence or being able to act against it?
I think the biggest challenge around sexualized violence, I would argue, is, you know, this very long history of talking of really relegating violence against women to the private realm. So there has always been a distinction, particularly in social movements. I'm not talking as much about mainstream society, but I'm talking even amongst people who are, you know, well-intentioned and wanting to address sexualized violence, is the distinction that we've made, which I think has been a very terrible one, between those issues that are imagined or conceived as so-called like real hard issues like economics and war and politics, and so-called soft issues, gender being considered the most kind of soft issue, which is something that is in the realm of the private, something that we're kind of fuzzy on. You know, one of my personal pet peeves is the fact that even in social movements and progressive spaces, we talk about non-consensual sex or non-consensual rape or non-consensual sexual interaction. And, you know, in my mind, anything that is non-consensual is rape. You can't talk about non-consensual sexual interaction as if though that's an adjective that is anything short of rape. And so the ways in which we've created gray areas around consent, the ways in which we have created gray areas in addressing violence against women, in relegating it to the private, right? The idea that we don't fully know what happens behind closed doors, we repeat that in various ways in social movements as well. And so I think that has been the most detrimental. So, at its root, the idea that we need to do much better at how we understand consent, understanding that anything short of yes is in fact no, what it means to believe survivors, what it means to really come to terms with how endemic sexual violence is, right? If we know that in Canada, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 women experience sexual violence, that means that we need to do a much better job of believing survivors. The fact that many people are talking about experiencing rape and sexual violence is horrific. And I think, you know, it's nothing short of a war on women, but we don't talk about it as such. We don't talk about the ways in which women and rape against women is a function of war, is a function of imperialism, is a function of colonialism and racism and all of these systems. It's kind of seen as a separate issue. And as I was saying earlier, it's seen as a kind of soft side private issue. And I think, in my mind, that's the biggest barrier to actually tackling patriarchy and sexual violence at the root, is the ways in which we have privatized it and really hidden it out of and really continue to perpetuate the fact that it takes place behind closed doors and not ever addressing it fully and openly.
Thank you, Emily. Now we have an analysis of the U.S. Democratic debate produced by News 101 correspondents Albert Von Sant and John Woodside.
The last Democratic debate before people head to the polls early next month was held on Monday in Charleston, South Carolina. The event was hosted by NBC's Lester Holt and Andrea Mitchell. In America, each state successively votes for who's going to be the presidential candidate for both major political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. These political races are called primary elections, and the first vote is in Iowa on February 1st, followed by New Hampshire on February 9th. Each candidate stuck to familiar talking points, making attacks from the left that have been heard throughout the campaign. Clinton questions Sanders' commitment to gun safety by citing past pro-gun votes that Sanders took. She also referenced the Charleston church shooting that happened in the same city where the debate was being held.
I have made it clear, based on Senator Sanders' own record, that he has voted with the NRA, with the gun lobby, numerous times. He voted against the Brady Bill 5 times. He voted for what we call the Charleston loophole. He voted for immunity from gun makers and sellers, which the NRA said was the most important piece of gun legislation in 20 years.
Sanders criticized Clinton as being a part of the political establishment, referring to her ties to large banks, including speaking fees she received from Goldman Sachs.
Here is the issue. Secretary touched on it. Can you really reform Wall Street when they are spending millions and millions of dollars on campaign contributions and when they are providing speaker fees to individuals? So it's easy to say, well, I'm going to do this and do that. But I have doubts when people receive huge amounts of money from Wall Street. I am very proud. I do not have a super PAC. I do not want Wall Street's money. I'll rely on the middle class and working families for my campaign contributions.
With voting just over a week away and the Democratic voters seemingly more split than ever, this once cordial race has become very heated. Bernie's sudden rise in popularity is a surprise to most American political pundits. Just last July, Hillary Clinton led Bernie Sanders by 40 points, 57% to 17%. Sanders has since rose to 38% in national polls and is currently beating Hillary in polls in both Iowa and New Hampshire. The self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist from Vermont now seems to have a legitimate chance at winning both the Democratic nomination and the presidency. The other hotly contested debate on Monday night was over health care plans. Senator Bernie Sanders is proposing a universal single-payer system similar to Canada's, where Hillary Clinton suggests expanding the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which is a hybrid between a social and private health care system. There was a third candidate on stage Monday night, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who is currently polling nationally at 2%. Martin O'Malley had trouble getting his ideas across at the debate on Monday night, as it seemed that moderator Lester Holt could care less about his opinions.
That's time. We're going to get into all that coming
Lester,
up, but we're going to take a break.
Seconds.
We need
just
to take a break,
seconds.
And when we come
all
back,
the things...
anger brewing in America.
You can hear O'Malley awkwardly snicker at the end of that exchange. As the primaries draw near, the Democratic race for presidential nominee becomes closer and closer. Clinton's once insurmountable lead is now only 8 points nationally, and she is losing in the first two primary states of New Hampshire and Iowa. How this race will turn out, no one is for sure. Reporting for CITR.
Thank you, Albert and John. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
So I'm online looking for a cool story to write about for this.
This Saturday, January 23rd, Party Well presents UBC's biggest fundraising party ever, FutureFest 2.0. 100% of the proceeds fund the construction of wells in Ethiopia through Charity Water. There will be an epic lineup and holograms made by UBC students. Happening at 8:30 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Nest, come get your tickets from the Party Well fam or online while they last, so you can have the time of your life while helping save a life. Check out Party Well on Facebook for all the information.
Thoughts about suicide must always be taken seriously. Learn how to help. Reaching out early and preventing suicide requires the help of everyone in the UBC community, so on Wednesday, January 27th, get involved with UBC's Suicide Awareness Day. Find out what you can do to help prevent suicide and to combat the stigma surrounding it. Spread the word and show the world that no one is ever alone by wearing orange to raise awareness. For more information about suicide awareness or for help, if you or someone you know is considering suicide, visit thrive.ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have Curious by Nature with Michael Ruffalo. This week, Michael looks at the impact of drones on marine wildlife.
So I'm online looking for a cool story to write about for this large assignment due in my journalism class. Coming from a biology background, I figured that I would keep my searches to include something science-y or something to do with animals. I happened to come across an article written by the CBC regarding a researcher at the Vancouver Aquarium. It turns out that some scientists are using drones. That's right, they're using the remote-controlled aircrafts that everyone wanted for Christmas to spy on their neighbors to capture images of killer whales off the coast of British Columbia. Perfect. This is great. I'll email the media team at the Vancouver Aquarium and set up an appointment. This is where things got a little interesting. After a quick exchange with the media coordinator from the aquarium, I was told that the researcher behind the study, this guy named Dr. Barrett Leonard, does not wish to be an advocate for drone technology. Right away I saw a red flag. I mean, what's the big deal? Why would this researcher not want to be known for being a pioneer in research techniques? So I do some research, and slowly, I begin to sink my body down the rabbit hole. Alright, the next thing I did was hop on Google to find some potential dirt on drones coming into contact with animals. Maybe there have been a few collisions. Maybe a drone killed an animal. Who knows? I just figured there had to be something on there that I could find.
And
I was right.
Our listeners to get
the University of Minnesota released a study in August. The researchers showed that when drones were flown above the heads of bears, their heart rates skyrocketed. One mother bear, out of fear for her nearby cubs, had her heart rate spike over 400% as she panicked. With that information and a few other press releases and studies, I felt confident going into my interview with the doctor a few days later. I pull up to the Vancouver Aquarium and sign in with a receptionist, who then leads me down this twisty hallway to the office of Dr. Barrett Leonard. He stands eye to eye as he greets me, and we shake hands. His outfit was rather casual, and his hair was both well-kept and frizzled all at once. Kind of strange, but I liked it. Anyways, we sit and exchange a few pleasantries, but really, I just jumped right into it. After a brief introduction to his research, I wanted to know how he really felt about drones being used to study whales and other animals in general. Did he feel like he was disturbing them? Could you even tell if you're disturbing them?
My gut feeling is that we're not disturbing them much. We haven't done the, you know, we haven't looked at heart rates, we haven't measured corticosteroids in, you know, fecal samples or something like that, so we don't know for sure. But I don't think we're disturbing them much, partly because we're not even getting a curiosity response, and that's just from having worked with whales for 25 years, killer whales. When they're really aware of something, they almost always check it out. So we really expected that they roll over and look at it.
Just kind of,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, and the fact that they don't,
happen.
That hasn't happened at all.
Okay.
So the fact that hasn't happened gives me some reason to think that we're not disturbing them. But I'm not 100% confident.
All right, that's fine. That makes sense. Being the expert that he is, Dr. Barrett Leonard believes that he can accurately tell when a whale is stressed out. The only problem with that statement is that it's a direct contradiction to something that he said earlier while answering that very same question.
Discerning the behavior of an animal based on, I mean, sorry, the stress experienced by an animal based on what it does is is fraud. You know, wild animals are pretty good at disguising a lot of things. So if you, you know, if you go out and do something, an animal changes its behavior, you can measure it before, then you know you've changed it. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. If you don't change, you know, if you don't pick up any behavioral distance difference, you can't really conclude that you haven't changed, you haven't disturbed it. You obviously haven't disturbed it in a way that you can detect.
And this makes sense too. Just because you don't notice a change doesn't mean that there isn't a change. This is the very reason why the researchers from Minnesota monitored the heart rate of bears. Heart rate is a more honest indicator of stress level than a behavior change. Thankfully, Dr. Barrett Leonard seemed to acknowledge this problem. He tells me that he and his team are careful not to disturb the whales as best as they can, flying drones high, over 100 feet above the orcas, doing their best to keep the machine's six spinning rotor blades quiet, and limiting the number of flights they do all go into limiting any potential harm. I wanted to know, though, why was he so concerned about being seen as a drone advocate? The term poster boy was even used. Poster boy? As if Dr. Barrett Leonard's frizzled hair is going to be printed on 8.5x11 paper and taped to lampposts? Regardless, I wondered why he was weary of this title. And his response was rather direct.
Because people like you keep on asking for interviews. Why, Michael?
A little tongue-in-cheek, sure. But his concerns are warranted. Dr. Barrett Leonard told me that he has witnessed horrible drone flying practices while working in South Africa. In order to get amazing footage, a drone operator was flying his machine just 5 feet above the ocean surface while a pod of dolphins were breaching and jumping. Thankfully, there were no collisions. But Baron Leonard is more worried about the future of drone usage in the Vancouver area, especially if technology gets into the hands of the whale-watching companies.
Whale watching is a big industry in BC. It's quite amazing, actually, how many thousands of people go out every year to watch whales. You know, if you had a bunch of drones flying over the whales at a given time, that really changes the nature of that viewing experience for the public as well. And every whale-watching company would love to have a drone of its own. I mean, imagine, there's nothing wrong with them wanting it. You know, if you could take a bunch of people out, you fly a drone off the boat, you take a video, there's the boat, there are the whales, you sell it to them at the end of the trip, kind of a good deal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if there are multiple drones flying over the whales, it's going to be banned. You're going to get whale-watching operators complaining about each other, you're going to have mid-air collisions, it could easily get out of control. Mm-hmm. You know, if a whale-watching association... You know, a bunch of companies got together and said, we're going to have one drone between us, we're going to fly it high, we're going to do one video a day, we're going to sell it to all of our customers. That might, I can't take a position on that. That might be just absolutely fine. But I think the proliferation of drones flying over the animals would be bad for a whole bunch of reasons. And not the least of which is we still don't know, if about the disturbance factor.
As I left the building with a smile on my face, I was satisfied with the answers that I was able to pull out, but I still wanted to know more. I got into contact with a local drone hobbyist by the name of Amiel de Guzman, and he told me of a strange phenomena that he encountered when he and his friend both flew their drones in close proximity to each other.
We had the same exact drone, and one of my wires, I think it exploded inside, because it didn't explode, but I think it was short circuit. I was seeing his feed. He was seeing my camera feed, so it was intertwining.
As you can imagine, this is not good. And Barrett Leonard's fears seem to be closer to reality than paranoia. After all, if just two drones in the air caused electrical interference, having dozens in the air in the hands of whale-watching companies would be disastrous. In late August of 2015, a Washington-based photographer broke the law and was charged when he flew a drone too close to a pod of orcas. We have similar laws in British Columbia. It turns out the photographer was doing all of this in order to capture film of swimming killer whales as a means of promoting his photography business. And despite being fined, the offenders still have the video posted on their YouTube channel to showcase their photography. So why does Dr. Barrett Leonard think he's exempt from backlash? Why is he allowed to continue to fly drones? Well, his research is steeped in conserving killer whale populations. The specific population that he studies, the southern residents, are critically endangered. And he looks to determine how healthy the whales are based on their body composition and which salmon populations are vitally important for the sustainability of this group of killer whales. The ultimate goal is conservation, and this may mean segregating a run of salmon so that the orcas can get a chance to feed and stay afloat. What this means for the salmon fishing industry remains uncertain, but for now, the skies above the killer whales will have a lone, buzzing follower.
Thank you, Michael. To conclude our show, we have Unseated Airwaves host Celia Joseph and her interview with Gunargi O'Sullivan.
We wanted to interview Gunargi O'Sullivan. Gunargi has been very dedicated to the Indigenous community in Vancouver and the radio community for a long time. She has been actively involved at various different radio stations in the country, bringing Indigenous voices to media in Vancouver and beyond. So she's been very active in the community, and we thought that she would be the perfect person to interview and ask about her experience in radio, what has drawn her to radio, and why it's an important medium for Indigenous people.
Alrighty, my name is Gunargi O'Sullivan. I am a Tsawitsi's member of Turner Island, and I'm also a broadcaster from Co-op Radio 100.5 FM CFRO.
So thank you so much for letting us interview you today and again interacting with CITR. And so Eleanor and I are here to get a little bit of background about the work that you do in the community, but we wanted to start at the beginning, and we wanted to ask you first, what drew you to radio and how did you get started?
I began in radio in 1985 and began. My name is Gunargi O'Sullivan. I'm a broadcaster at Co-op Radio 100.5 FM CFRO, www.coopradio.org. I do a number of programs at Co-op Radio on Monday between 1 o'clock and 2:30. I am the host and producer of When Spirit Whispers. On Tuesdays, I do a show called Snow Wilds, which airs every Tuesday between 1 o'clock and 2. Again, I'm the producer and host of that show. Late Night with Savages, Wednesday nights between 11 and 12, I co-host with Gary Over. And Thursdays between 5 o'clock and 6, I've had the pleasure of working with Ross Bone, Spencer Lindsay, as well as Gary Over between 5 o'clock and 6.
Great. Thank you so much. So what drew you to radio, and how did you get started in this field?
In 1986, I was introduced to my brother, Raymond Williams, who was currently working on a show called When Spirit Whispers, which aired every Wednesday night between 11 and 12 o'clock. He was the one that introduced me to radio.
Okay, and what was his involvement in radio, and what attracted you to it?
Well, he was at the time the producer and the host of When Spirit Whispers. And he had heard some of my poetry, realized that I was interested in communications, and he encouraged me to become a part of the radio show. And at that time, I was a little bit shy, not only of being First Nations, but also of my own voice. And so I backed away. I decided, no, I'm too scared. I don't know. I was this and that. And then I met another woman who was working with him at the time, and her name was Carrie Charney. And she kind of pulled me back in to the station and just kind of threw me to the wolves. The next thing you know, I started getting the hang of it. I would do public service announcements, introduce songs, and then I eventually started covering stories. In fact, one of the first stories I covered was with the Spokane Valley blockade that was happening, and to this day is still going on. It's blockade which involves the Sinaiks people.
Wow. So it seems as you were getting your footing in radio, you were also getting your own grounding in your identity as an Indigenous woman.
Exactly. You know, radio has been a great tool in educating me and helping me to communicate issues with the greater community.
And so what has kept you going in radio all this time? It seems like you have a really long history in it, and what has kept you interested and enthused about it?
Well, I would have to say the community itself, the issues. I am a person who learns from listening. I come from an oral background, and I am most comfortable listening, and I have been able to find my voice. And the longer I've stuck to community and campus radio, the more I've come to know, the more I feel secure in my own skin and feel feel confident of being a First Nations woman. And then throughout that, I've met other people who work in radio but don't always identify them as First Nation themselves as First Nations people. So I've come to understand that there is a need for our perspectives, and those perspectives actually help our community who has been displaced through residential school, foster care, and adoption in regaining their own identities. So that drives me. It helps me to realize that there is a need for our perspectives, why there is a need for us and our perspectives. And I know that it's important and that there is a lack of First Nations, again, the word perspective, in media, not just in mainstream, but even in community and at a campus radio level.
I really like that connection that you've drawn between urban Indigenous populations that have been displaced or have left their communities and radio. And I can see my own connection in being in radio in the first place, and I hadn't thought about it in that way until you brought that up, so I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
And so why do you think that radio specifically can be a unique tool for Indigenous people? Why do you think that Native people can be drawn to it, and how we can relate to the medium?
I think that radio can be used as a skill to develop our tools and for us to reconnect to our oral history. And I value radio on many levels. If we allow ourselves to have a voice and to reconnect with our culture through communications, it will only make us stronger as a people.
And so now I'd really like to dive into some more information about the current shows that you have right now. Could you tell us a little bit about what makes each show distinct from the other?
Okay. Well, When Spirit Whispers has been on the air for over 20 years now. It's one of the longest running programs at Co-op Radio. That show has developed from arts and communication to a show that specifically explores the idea of truth and reconciliation. It has focused on the residential school agreement, how that has worked and not worked for the people. It has shared stories from the community about residential school survival and intergenerational survival. And now we're moving towards the idea of healing. How can we rise above the atrocities and the findings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and move forward? That's where we're at. We are also actually exploring the treaty negotiation process within the idea of reconciliation.
Okay. So this show, When Spirit Whispers, was what brought you to radio in the first place with your brother Raymond, right?
Right.
How does it feel to now be still engaging with the show? How has it changed while you have changed?
Well, it has changed because I've been able to, when you think about it, I didn't meet my brother until I was 20 years old. And he was adopted, and I was adopted. I was a residential school survivor and an intergenerational survivor. He was a intergenerational survivor. That in itself is kind of interesting and a form of reconciliation. We're able to meet each other, grow as a family, and reconcile with our experience. I've been able to understand my own mother, who is a survivor, through the teachings I have had as a radio producer and a broadcaster. I haven't been able to forgive her and understand why she was not able to take care of me. And as I said, I'm a survivor of residential school myself. I went to foster care, I went to residential schools, and then I was later adopted. So I see myself as somebody who has gone through the full nine yards. You know, I've been an orphan. My mother died when I was 6 years old. My dad died when I was 10. And as a result of that, I went to the residential school, and then I was adopted. So I've been through the 60 scoop, which is directly related to the residential schools. So I've been able to understand myself better as a person, as a First Nations person, as a survivor, and an intergenerational survivor, which is a lot. That's a lot of healing
Thank you, Celia. To hear the full interview with Ganarji O'Sullivan, check out the November 16th episode of Unseated Airwaves on CITR.ca. That's our program for today, January 22nd. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news-101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud page. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Emily Blake. Today's broadcast was produced by Sam Moore. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
Stay tuned for Lady Radio from the Women's Collective, right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have Bob Ross by Future Kids. Their album, This Is Everything, is number 22 on this week's Top 30 at CITR.
My mind.